Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, why was Hildebrand Gurlitt released after the Monuments Men had found 20 boxes of stolen artwork in his possession and he was captured by American troops in 1945? Emilio Ramos Sabas is a Spanish lawyer who received a master's degree in refugee law from the University of London, with a specialization in human rights practice from the London School of Economics. He recently gave a presentation at Centro Sefarad Israel on the theft of artworks by the Nazis, the unforeseen consequences of the Gurlitt case. This week, Ramos is speaking with us about the Nazis' idea of degenerate art, the pieces that were stolen by them, and what eventually happened to these artworks. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Emilio. Now, the title of your talk was The Nazis' Theft of Artworks, The Unforeseen Consequences of the Gurlitt Case. Could you first please tell us briefly about the Nazis' attitude towards art and especially how they viewed contemporary art as opposed to more classical, realistic art?
Well, yes, the Nazis wanted to exalt and idealize human body representing those aesthetic values of the so-called Aryan race. Actually, it can be considered an insolent classicism. Its agitation of the form reflecting power and reason in contrast to expressionism, another avant-garde artistic movement that were forbidden by the regime. It does not contribute anything from an artistic viewpoint, except for the historical context where it took place.
Can you tell us what their idea was of degenerate art and why they associated it specifically with the Jews?
Well, the term degenerate art was coined by Max Nordau at the end of 19th century as a result of a crisis of values and other references that were challenged along that century. It can be seen in those movements that wanted to defy the establishment with a new artistic expressions like impressionism that were hardly criticized by Nordau, even saying that was a reflection of antisemitism. We have to remember that a few years later, after Nordau's essay Degeneration was published, in France came out the Dreyfus Affair, unjustly blaming a Jewish-French officer of betrayal. Nordau himself was Jewish, the son of an Orthodox rabbi, and he personally was very much involved in the Zionist movement. Years later, the Nazi borrowed the term, applying it to any work of art considered politically incorrect, contradicting what the Nazis regarded as real art based on the classical models, as opposed to deviated art where the human form was unfinished or exaggerated, as mentioned before. So the Nazis wanted to show what degenerate art was by organizing an exhibition in 1937, gathering paintings exhibited in German museums around the country, which the Nazis labeled as degenerate in the way I described before. They used drawings made by mentally disabled people combined with pictures of physically disabled people. They wanted to highlight that the art Sikh and Jewish Bolshevik, in fact, this wanted to legitimize the persecution of those racially inferior and political opponents. They also organized a second exhibition, the Great German Art Exhibition at the House of Culture, also in Munich, showing the aesthetic ideals of Nazism already described as well.
I think that that's a little bit ironic for two reasons. First of all, because apparently the exhibit of degenerate art was very, very popular and millions of people went to see it. And then on the other hand, Bolshevik art in the 30s was also very, very realistic and idealizing the worker, and it wasn't at all what we might call modern or surrealistic or anything like that.
Soviet art, yeah. In fact, it was the course, you know, the way they the Soviet painters, you know, try to, well, to give answer, you know, to this kind of, well, political ideas, you know.
When did the Nazis actually begin to confiscate artworks, and do you have any idea how many they confiscated and what they did with them?
Yeah, well, Goebbels created the so-called Commission for the Exploitation of the Degenerate Art in 1937, which led to establish the official Nazi Confiscation Service, the ERR. The main goal of the service was not only the confiscation itself, but also the sale of these assets in the international market. In addition to this, Hitler wanted to set up a museum in his hometown in Linz, Austria, gathering the most important European works of art. To achieve this goal, he launched a program of systematic theft of art, which affected Jews from Germany and other countries, as well as European public institutions.
Do you know how many works were involved altogether?
We're talking about more than 5 million, which were ripped off by the Nazis.
5 million?
Yeah, altogether.
Wow.
Yeah, along Europe, yeah.
Were they only paintings, or were they all...
Sculptures as well, I mean, engravings, many other, you know, works of art, of course.
5 million is a lot of artworks. What did the Nazis do with them?
Well, the best thing of the classical works was the museum that Hitler was planning to build in his hometown, as mentioned before. Also, Goering was very interested in having a private collection of art and played a key role in this process of systematic robbery which took place in Europe. However, as the museum was never built, such amount of pieces of art stolen were stored, among other places, in abandoned salt mines, for example, in Austria, where the Monuments Men, the famous Monuments Men, found, for example, the Madonna Michelangelo, stolen in Bruges, or a couple of Vermeer's paintings. On the other hand, the Nazis sold most of the 1,000 paintings and 3,000 engravings of the exhibition of the degenerate art in the international art market. The same happened with other degenerate pieces of art, many of which were stolen to US owners. To manage the commercialization of these assets in the foreign market, a specific group of people was commissioned, and in particular, Hildebrand Gurlitt.
So tell us a little bit about Gurlitt. Who was he, and how did he happen to get involved in this?
He was an art dealer. Before that, he was working as director of the museum, a museum in Hamburg. However, he was fired as a result of the Nazi racial laws because his grandmother was Jewish. So he had to open an art gallery in Dresden. Specifically, the Goebbels appointed Hildebrand Gurlitt, despite his Jewish background, as commissioner to sell the degenerate art because of his knowledge on modern art and his contacts with other European and North American art dealers. This allowed him to sell the degenerate art while making profit to finance, among other things, the German armament industry.
But he also amassed quite a collection himself. Can you tell us how he happened to get such a big collection and what happened to it and how many of these works were still in his possession when he died in 1956?
Well, many of these artworks could not put on the market simply because the German troops were advancing throughout Europe and there was no longer art market, for example, in France or in the Netherlands. He held many of these pieces for him, while later was his private collection. At the end of the war, he was captured with his wife by the American troops in June 1945 in a castle in Asbach, whose owner was Baron von Pollitz, the mayor of the town. The Monuments Men found 20 boxes of artworks. Gurlitt claimed that they were part of his personal collection. He also said that the other part of the collection was destroyed during the bombing of Dresden in February 1945. He defined himself as a victim of Nazi persecution because of his Jewish background, and for those reasons he was released.
That's also kind of ironic that the Nazis took advantage of him as an art dealer, even though he had a Jewish background, and then he was able to use his Jewish background to get released from the Allies. So, What happened to the artworks when he died? And why is this collection particularly special?
Well, there were around 1,400 paintings and engravings. So when he died, his son Cornelius inherited the entire collection except for a few paintings that were sold to other art dealers before his father's death. And well, a special note of this collection is, well, it's trying to reflect very compulsive times. Since most of the paintings are expressionist, they reflect the anxiety that in a way the distress of the 20s and 30s in Germany and predict what was about to happen to the Jewish owners.
So tell us about Cornelius. He inherited the collection, you say, and what did he do with the works and how were they eventually discovered?
The life of Cornelius Gurlitt is much darker, certainly boring. It changed when in 2010 the German customs officers stopped him while entering Germany from Switzerland carrying 9,000 euro in cash. He explained this as a product of a transaction with the gallery Confer in Bern. Gurlitt was allowed to continue his way, but he had arisen suspicion. The additional inquiries led the investigators to discover that Gurlitt has never been employed and was not registered with the tax authorities or social services and no pension or health insurance. He was defined by Vanity Fair as a ghost. As a result of the inquiries at the end of February 2012, the authorities searched his flat and found more than 1,400 paintings. What he did, basically, he maintained this collection for the sake of his own enjoyment.
And where are they now?
Once the collection was discovered in Cornelius' flat, the judicial authorities got involved. In view of that, on April 2014, Gurlitt signed an agreement with the Federal Republic of Germany and the Free State of Bavaria, accepting the intervention of the so-called working group, an agency created by the German government in order to investigate the provenance of the artworks. However, the working group could not make any decision concerning restitution, as did not have the authority of a civil or arbitral court. In the absence of a court decision, only Mr. Gurlitt had the capacity to finally dispose of the assets by waiving the 30-year statute limitation. It is worth recalling that Germany had a 30-year statute limitation for cases involving stolen property beginning at the time of the property that the property was taken. Therefore, the last time a former owner could have filed a claim for restitution of Nazi looted art against an individual was 1975. From a legal viewpoint, Gurlitt has no duty to return the assets to the Holocaust victims nor to the heirs.
But did Cornelius have any idea whose property they had originally been? He probably didn't even know.
As mentioned before, it was this working group was drafting a final report. So in this report, actually only could identify the provenance of 11 artworks. And of these 11, the group was only able to clearly identify the ownership of only 5. So it was not very clear indeed. So however, as far as I know, only 2 of them were returned. Hmm. As 2 riders off on the beach, painted by Max Liebermann, which was being returned to David Thoring, the nephew of the owner, after filing a claim against Germany. The other was Seated Woman by Henri Matisse, which was returned to Elaine Osenberg, a descendant of Paul Osenberg, the famous art dealer, who represented, among others, Pablo Picasso, Georges Braque, and Henri Matisse.
So if only 2 were returned, what happened to the rest of them?
Well, they are basically in the museum. So now, well, finally, they are in a big museum in Bern. Because, this collection, Cornelius Gurlitt, was handed over to this museum in Bern according to his will. So the will was executed and the whole collection was handed over to the museum. The museum, of course, in Bern, took some time to think about whether or not they received the bequest, but finally they decided to receive the bequest because, of course, was an important collection, and they accepted as well the Washington Principles endorsed in the Washington Conference some years ago.
Tell us about that. Tell us about the Washington Principles.
Well, the Washington Principles are guidelines which try to set up, you know, the basics of what we should do with those artworks stolen by the Nazis, looted by the Nazis. So the problem basically was, as far as law issues are concerned, the main problem here was basically the provenance, the origins of the works, and on the other hand, how to apply the law, having in mind that the law of different countries are completely different. So we have to try what is called in private international law the conflict of laws. That's the main goal. Also, of course, have to, you know, to consider many of the circumstances that are around the Holocaust victims. You know. To be most precise, at the end of 1998, a conference was organized in Washington to tackle these issues that arise from the Nazi looted art. The conference was attended by 44 countries and 13 NGOs and agreed on, as said before, 11 non-binding principles. So although it is not a binding treaty, the principles are firm guidelines on the situation and provide the basis for just and fair solutions, having in mind the circumstances of the Holocaust. In 2014, the World Jewish Institution Organization examined the progress made in implementation of the Washington Principles, establishing four categories: countries that have made major progress, countries that have made substantial progress, countries that have taken some steps, and countries that do not appear to have made significant progress. Although it's not very clear to me, Austria and Germany fall into the category of countries that have made major progress, and the United States falls into the category of countries that have made substantial progress.
So, as you said, the Washington Conference was held in 1998. That was 20 years ago. Are they still working on it? Are the descendants of Holocaust victims still trying to get some of these works back, or have they just kind of given up?
Yeah, there are some claims. There are a couple of quite well-known claims which are, you know, in the process of being decided particularly in the United States, and of course in the United States. But I had the impression that the principles that were not successful, as you know, as was designed. Some of proceedings open in different countries, particularly in the United States, they apply exception in the law, which provides for what open those proceedings in the United States instead of European countries where the paintings are located. But yeah, there are a few cases, and of course there are a lot of money involved in that process, legal processes. That's why it's very important to apply the Washington Principles, because the Washington Principles try to reduce legal timing and, of course, all the costs involved. They try to apply an alternative dispute resolution mechanism, which provides for, practical solution involving the parties and, limiting the cost of the process of judicial process.
Okay, so going back to the title of your talk, what were the unforeseen consequences of the Gerlitt case?
Well, I would say that it's quite ironic that Gerlitt's father and his son play a strange role in this story, you know, because, Hildebrand Gerlitt can be defined as the first trustee, you know, because he hold the paintings really as a trustee, since allowed that many of these paintings were not lost. The same happened to his son Cornelius. Let's say that he acts as a sort of trustee number two, as he handed over the collection to the Bern Museum while repairing the situation in some way. And thirdly, the Bern Museum, acting as trustee number three, confirms, it assumes, the Washington Principles in relation to the restitution of the painting. So it's kind of sort of reparation. And of course, they were not lost.
Is there anything else you would like to add that we might have left out?
Well, just to say that many of the rightful owners were killed in the concentration camps and there were no descendants. So it is sad to see how these works are located in many museums in Germany or Austria or France. As a friend of mine pointed out, it would be fair to consider Israel as the final depository of these artworks stolen by the Nazis to the Jewish people.
Thank you very much. That's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirot.com. See you next week.